Toke may have been a jerk, but he could do wonders with body filler and paint. That's how he met Jeannie Hicks. She'd hit a fence post with her car and brought it into Dubs to get it fixed. Things kind of went from there. But if Toke was such a jerk, why would any woman... Jeannie was a rebel back then. She probably got swept up in that bad boy thing. Personally, I think she started dating Toke just to piss off her old man. But it got out of hand, and they ended up getting married. Toke could be a charmer if he wanted to be.
And Jeannie had money? I asked.
Arvin Hicks, her dad, had the money. The Hicks family owned some of the best river-bottom farmland in the state.
Jeb pointed west.
Head down the highway about 8 miles and you'll find their farm.
He had money? I said.
Hicks passed on about a year ago. You see, Arvin Hicks hated Toke. He told Jeannie that she wouldn't get a penny of inheritance unless she divorced him. But then Arvin died without a will. I suspect he couldn't bring himself to put his anger into writing. When he died, the law gave the whole kit and caboodle to Jeannie.
I read about Jeannie's death when I was researching, I said. She died 6 months ago, right? Jeb nodded, his eyes again fixed on the pavement at his feet. I waited for him to say something more, but he didn't. So I asked,
how'd she die?
He tightened his lips, as if fighting to hold back something deep. Then he said,
she committed suicide. Angel found her hanging in their horse barn.
Jeb stumbled a little on his words as he spoke, and I could sense the history between them. Angel found her?
Yeah, really did a number on that girl.
Why would Jeannie...
I mean, did she leave a note or anything? Jeannie was always an anxious girl, and after she had that falling out with her father, well, I guess the anxiety just got worse. She left a note talking about how Arvin's death put her into a depression that she couldn't climb out of. After she and Toke moved out to the farm, we got at least 3 calls from Jeannie because of her panic attacks. EMTs would show up, and she would be curled up in a ball trying to breathe.
You knew Jeannie pretty well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Given the melancholy that showed on his face, I left it at that. We stood there in silence until it became too awkward for me to handle, and I said,
when Jeannie died, I take it she left everything to Toke? Jeannie didn't have a will either, he said. Toke got the farm by law, and now that Toke's dead...
Jeb looked at me as if it was my turn to say something, but I just blinked at him.
If you really are his son...
Then it hit me. Holy crap, I whispered.
You an angel.
I had no idea. I swear, I didn't...
So you see why Nathan thinks that you might be a suspect.
I would never... I know you don't know me from Adam, but I would never...
It's a lot of money.
How much are we talking about?
I don't know the exact figure. The guy you need to talk to is Bob Mullen. He's the attorney handling the estate. Jeannie worked for him as a paralegal before she...
And what about Angel? I asked. I've heard rumors that she's in a bad way.
You know, Joe, I did some checking on you this morning. I found that police report you mentioned, the one where Toke hit your mother. Everything seems to match up with what you said happened. As far as I can tell, you just might be Toke's son.
I think that's a pretty good bet, I said. Jeb turned his head to look at me, pausing again before saying what he had on his mind.
I'm going to tell you something, Joe. I'm probably crossing a line here, so I'd appreciate it if you don't hang me out to dry on this.
I nodded my agreement.
The way I see it, if you are Angel's half-brother, you have a right to know. Angel's in a coma up in Mankato.
A coma? What happened?
I was the first one out to the farm the night Toke died. I found Angel in her bedroom, non-responsive. She was barely breathing, and there was an empty prescription bottle on a table near the bed. Clonazepam. It was Jeannie's prescription. Toke should have thrown it away. He had no business keeping meds like that around the house.
Will she be okay? Jeb didn't answer. So that's why you think Charlie's in town. Jeb nodded.
I doubt if Charlie could pick Angel out of a lineup if he had to. Toke dies, leaving all that money to Angel. But Angel's only 14. Can't legally do anything with the farm. Whoever becomes her guardian will control her share of the estate. I think that's why Charlie crawled out of the woodwork.
Then Jeb turned to face me, planting one arm on the top of his car. He lowered his sunglasses to lock his eyes onto mine, and he said,
I'm telling you all this because I think Angel deserves better than what she's getting. If I find out that you are just here for her money, I'll...
He didn't finish his thought. He didn't have to. I said, if I went up to visit Angel, do you think they'd let me see her? Jeb smiled at that. He struck me as a thoughtful man, the kind of guy who had seen enough in his lifetime to walk with deliberate steps.
I could see him thinking on my question, waiting for the heavy stones of right and wrong to balance out. Then, he said, I was planning on heading up there tomorrow. You can ride along with me if you want. I'm willing to bet that we can get you in to see her.
Chapter 13. The library in Buckley was smaller than my apartment, and empty of people, except for a mother reading children's books to her three docile kids. I sat down at one of the two computer carrels and fired up the internet. My first search, Charlie Talbert. Charlie lived large on the internet, the kind of guy who found celebrity in having his name appear in as many places as possible, self-promoting tripe that blared his accomplishments like a row of heralding trumpets. Uncle Charlie wanted the world to see him as a successful businessman, and he seemed to excel at getting his picture taken with famous people, politicians, movie stars, even a former governor of Minnesota. At first glance, he appeared to live on the opposite end of the spectrum from his brother, Joe. But I was an AP reporter. Research was my stock in trade. I knew the false fronts that people could present when they had something to hide, so I took my time, clicking past what Charlie wanted me to see to find what he wanted to hide. Nearly 2 hours had passed before I found my first breadcrumb, a news report about a fire at a warehouse in St. Paul 3 years ago. The building housed the offices and manufacturing floor of a company developing a new form of prosthetic limb, and a man named Casey Levin died in the fire. The article reported that the origins of the fire were under investigation. Charlie's name came up only once, when the article identified him as a minority partner in the company and the beneficiary of a $1 million personal insurance policy on the dead man. I clicked around looking for a follow-up story or anything that might give me more information on the fire, but came up with Bubkiss. So I decided to research two other subjects that I had on my mind, comas and clonazepam. On comas, I found a great deal of information, but very little that helped, as it all seemed intentionally vague. Yes, comas were bad, and yes, if it was bad enough, you'd die. They could last hours, or they could last months. They could result in total brain damage or no brain damage at all. After an hour of searching, I felt like I had found nothing concrete on any of the sites. On the other hand, I found a ton of good information on clonazepam, an anti-panic medication that had recently become a go-to date rape drug. It could disorient a person, take away their inhibitions, knock them out, and hide the crime with a nice blanket of amnesia. Too much of the drug could put you in a coma or kill you. As I read about clonazepam, my mind drifted to thoughts of Lila. She had been raped in high school, waking up in the back seat of her own car, naked and unable to remember what happened. She always suspected that she had been drugged, and after reading about clonazepam, I wondered if that had been the pill they used. I had been lost in my research for hours. I didn't realize how much time had passed until I felt the sting of fatigue in my eyes and the pang of hunger in my stomach. I had worked right through the lunch hour, and dinner time was fast approaching. I needed food, so I headed to the Snipe's Nest. The bar was about half full of people, one of whom was my Uncle Charlie, sitting at a high top in the corner eating fries from a red basket and watching the twins on the TV on the wall. He gave me a cold look as I passed. Vicky was still working the bar, shuffling food orders from the kitchen and mixing drinks. She smiled at me as she passed with a big plate of chicken wings. I took a seat on the same stool I'd sat on earlier. Beside me, a couple of women, one in her mid-50s and the other a decade younger, leaned against the bar in a stance that suggested they were awaiting food orders. The older one, the one closest to me, said,
"That's him down there."
I glanced at her in the mirror above the bar and saw that she was pointing at Uncle Charlie.
"He knows Clint Eastwood and Governor Pawlenty. I saw the pictures online." "That's Toke's brother?"
the younger woman said, twisting her neck to get a better look.
"Yeah," the older one said. "He wants guardianship of that poor girl, God bless him. He's exactly what she needs after what she's been through. I met him when he stepped by the office yesterday, asking if I can speed up the background study, and I told him that I can't do anything until a petition is filed. And today, voila, he files a petition." "That couldn't have worked out any better," the younger one said. "I think the judge is anxious to get him appointed. Someone has to look out for Angel. This might be the fastest background study I've ever done. Who'd have thought that Toke Talbert could have a brother who knows Clint Eastwood? Well, Cain had Abel, didn't he?"
Vicky stepped back behind the bar, gave a couple of sandwich baskets to the ladies, and they retreated with their food to a nearby booth.
"Drink?"
she asked me. "A beer," I said. "Something local."
"Coming right up."
She poured a beer and placed it on a coaster in front of me.
"Here you go, little Toke."
"Oh, no, don't even start. I'm Joe. Just plain Joe." I heard someone in the booth behind me say Toke. I glanced over my shoulder at three guys drinking beer, construction workers, given the paint on their jeans and the worn shine on the tips of their steel-toed boots. One of them, a guy wearing a Pink Floyd t-shirt, looked at me like I was a crossword he couldn't figure out. Then to Vicky, he said,
"How about another round over here?" "You might want to pace yourself, Harley,"
Vicky said, as she reached under the bar for three bottles of Budweiser.
"This ain't a race."
She set the bottles on the bar and opened them.
"Bring them here." "You want beer? Get off your ass and come get it."
The man in the Pink Floyd shirt, the one Vicky called Harley, stood up and walked the three paces to the bar. I could feel his eyes on me as he picked up the bottles of beer. Then he returned to his booth.
"Any update on who killed your old man?"
It struck me as odd that she asked that question with the same nonchalance that she had when she asked me if I wanted a beer. "They're not telling me much, but I believe you were right when you said that they have their sights set on Moody Lynch.
Nathan Calder would blame Moody for the Kennedy assassination if he could,"
she said. "Why's that?"
"Them two have a history."
Vicky leaned on the bar and spoke in a voice just above a whisper.
"And it's a juicy one."
"Do tell."
"A couple of years ago, Nathan busted Moody for some minor possession. I think it was just pot. After that, Nathan started pulling Moody over every chance he got. Window tint, loud muffler, that kind of crap. And every time, Nathan would search for drugs. Well, that started to piss Moody off. So Moody took up watching Nathan, spying on him. And Moody Lynch ain't gonna be seen if he don't want to be. He can disappear into the leaves like one of them lizards that change colors."
"Chameleon?"
"Yeah, a chameleon. So Moody's watching Nathan every day. And pretty soon, he figures out that Nathan's been sneaking off in his squad car with Janice Meyer from the court administrator's office. He followed them out to the river and found where they liked to get it on. Well, the next time they decided to sneak off, Moody was waiting with one of them infrared trail cameras. Caught Nathan and Janice in the act. Next thing you know, a copy of that footage shows up in the mail, addressed to Nathan's wife and Janice's husband. It was a huge scandal. Nathan got divorced over it. Almost lost his job. I think if he had the chance, he'd put a bullet through Moody's head."
Again, from the booth behind me, Harley yelled,
"For Christ's sake, Vic, will you stop flirting with that douchebag and do your job?" "What the hell are you squawking about?"
Vicky said.
"I want another beer. The service here sucks."
"I just gave you a beer."
Harley stood up and walked to the bar, slamming his empty beer bottle down.
"As you can see, it's empty."
He slid the bottle toward Vicky, and it fell behind the bar, landing on a rubber mat without breaking. Again, I could feel his eyes on me. Instead of getting Harley a beer, Vicky went to the opening between the bar and the kitchen and got the attention of the cook. As they spoke, Vicky kept glancing over her shoulder at Harley, but Harley didn't notice. He kept his eyes locked on me.
"Are you really Tokes, kid?"
he said, his words slurred and dripping with contempt. I didn't answer.
"I said, are you Tokes, kid? Are you little Toke?"
"Who I am is none of your business," I said it as calmly as I could.
"The hell it ain't. If you're Toke's kid, you owe me some money."
I pinched my lips and slowly shook my head and said, "I don't know you shit."
"Harley, go sit down," Vicky said. "Not until little Toke here agrees to pay me my money."
I could tell that Harley had been drinking for a while. One hand on the bar to steady himself, eyes as glassy as frog's eggs.
"Your old man screwed me out of 15 grand. You're gonna get some of that Hicks money, so the way I see it, you can pay off his debt."
He gave a shove to my shoulder that nearly pushed me off my stool.
"Damn it, Harley," Vicky yelled. "Leave him alone."
She reached across the bar, grabbing Harley by his shirt. He swatted her hand away. Now I stood up and faced him. "I don't know you," I said, "and I don't owe you any money. Go sit down." Harley looked at his buddies, who I suspected were ready to jump into the fight if Harley needed them. Then he turned back to me.
"Are you calling me a liar?"
"No, you've made a mistake. That's all. Just go back to your friends."
"Are you a cheat like your old man?"
Harley took a step into me, although I think it was more a matter of losing his balance than anything else. I stepped back to keep an arm's length between us.
"You're drunk, Harley," Vicky said. "Go sit down." "You stay out of this, Vic. This is between me and little Toke here."
He reached out to poke me on the chest, and I swatted his hand away.
"Don't go there," I said. With that, he perked up like I just slapped his face. "Oh, you want to have a go, do you?"
He took another step into me, this time on purpose. I again stepped back.
"Don't do it, Harley," I said. "I don't want to fight you." "I bet you don't."
He stepped at me a third time, and before I could step back, he reached out for my shirt. I grabbed his hand with both of mine and twisted his arm upside down so that the knot of his elbow pointed at the ceiling. I pulled his upturned elbow under my armpit, lifted my legs, and let gravity take us to the floor. He landed harder than I had intended, and the sickening crack of his face hitting the wood worried me a bit. One of Harley's friends, the smallest of the three, began to slide out of the booth, so I yelled,
"Don't move, or I'll break his arm."
The kid stood up, unsure of what to do next. I raised my foot to kick the kid if he came any closer and cranked Harley's arm some more.
"Tell your friend to stay put." "Ow, son of a bitch!"
Harley hollered. The kid moved a step closer, his eyes darting around, looking for a way to come at me.
"Tell him to sit the fuck down."
I leaned into Harley's twisted arm, taking his wrist and elbow to the edge of breaking.
"Sit down, fuck!"
Harley screamed. The guy moved back to the booth. I eased up on Harley a bit to stop his screaming.
"Now here's what we're going to do," I said. "You boys can either leave peacefully out that back door, or I can keep Harley here in pain until the law arrives. It's your choice."
"Fuck you,"
Harley said.
"Law it is."
"No, man," said the kid. "I'm on probation and hell, so are you. Let's just go."
The third guy, the one who sat quietly while the fight went down, dropped a $10 bill on the table, got up, and walked out without saying a word. The guy on probation hesitated for a couple beats but relented and followed his friend out the door. With Harley alone, I felt pretty good about my situation. I loosened his arm a bit.
"Harley, I got nothing against you. I'm going to let you up. You can walk out of here or you can stay and fight, but you should know that Vicky has already called the cops."
Vicky picked up her phone and held it, as if that were true. With his face against the floor, Harley didn't know the difference.
"You can walk out of here and let it be, or we can go another round. It's your choice."
I let go of his wrist and scrambled up. Harley climbed to his feet, his face almost purple with rage, his eyes watering. He held his right wrist, working his fist in a small circle, probably gauging its strength. Then, he looked at Vicky, who still held her phone halfway up to her ear. He spat at the floor near my feet and walked away. Most of the patrons looked at me with a mix of fear and surprise. The lady doing Charlie's background study seemed particularly shocked by what I'd done, her eyes popping, mouth hanging open. Charlie remained at his table in the corner, a strange smile on his face like he'd just bested me somehow. I sat back down on my bar stool, my fingers shaky from the adrenaline rush. Vicky stood across the bar from me, leaning in close enough so that I could smell her perfume and catch a glimpse of the black lace of her bra behind the V-neck of her t-shirt.
Where do you learn to handle drunks like that?
I used to be a bouncer, I said, averting my eyes away from Vicky's cleavage. I looked at the tattoo on her arm, the candle with the cursive writing below it. From this close, I could read the words under the candle. My mother, my light.
You were a bouncer? And here I thought you were just some desk jockey reporter. Damn.
Don't be too impressed. I mostly just checked IDs.
The way you handled Harley Redding just now? You may not be burly, but you got some moves.
I took what she said as a compliment, even though I didn't like being reminded that I was a bit undersized. I've had my ass handed to me plenty of times, I said. My luck was bound to run out sooner or later, so I went to college. You don't need survival skills when you sit behind a desk.
What I wouldn't give to go to college and get the hell out of this hole. You have no idea.
You should do it, I said, sounding like the jackass that I often was. When I was at the U, I knew people who went to school by day and bartended at night.
If only it were that easy, she said.
If I can do it, anyone can.
No,
she said, looking at me through wistful eyes.
Not anyone. For some of us, it's just not in the cards.
The heaviness in her words told me to let it go, and I suspected that the ground we were covering had become hard-packed long before I arrived in Buckley. She moved down the bar to serve drinks to some of the other patrons, and by the time she returned, I had prepared a question for her that had nothing to do with college or bartending or being stuck in a small town.
Do you have any idea what that guy, Harley, was so mad about? What did Toke owe him money for?
Vicky's playful side came back.
I don't know, but I bet I could find out. A small town like this, someone's bound to know.
And how'd he know about me being in line for Toke's money?
Toke's murder is a big deal around here. It's all people are talking about. And if you're Toke's son, then you and Angel get the Hicks farm, right? At least that's the gossip.
Gossip? I just got here.
Oh, honey. This place is nothing but dry grass and tinder waiting for a spark of gossip to set it on fire. Nothing stays a secret in Buckley.
If it works out that I get a dime, I'll be surprised, I said.
Have you seen the farm? The Hicks place?
No.
I'm off after the dinner shift. Stick around, and I'll take you out there.
I wouldn't want to put you out.
It's no big deal, she said. That's my neck of the woods. I could show you around.
I thought about her offer. What could it hurt? If nothing else, I'd have an idea of what Uncle Charlie had at the center of all his scheming. If it turned out that I was, in fact, Toke Talbert's son, it might be nice to have some perspective on the tides moving around me. If not, all I would have wasted was a couple of hours of my time. Okay, I said. Let's do that. But I'm going to take my supper back to the motel and eat it there. I don't want Harley rethinking his decision and coming back here for me. I'm staying at the Caspian Inn.
I know. Roommate. How do you... I told you. Nothing stays a secret in Buckley.
Chapter 14. In July, the evening sun can linger in the sky until nearly 9 o'clock. So when Vicky showed up at my motel at 8, I figured that an hour would be more than enough time to drive out to the Hicks farm and back before dark. When the knock came, I answered the door to find Vicky in a black leather jacket, black gloves, and her hair tied back in a ponytail.
You got a jacket?
She asked.
A sweatshirt?
I said, giving a quick glance to the cloudless sky.
You may want to put it on.
She nodded toward a motorcycle parked across the lot. It was a mean-looking thing, black and sleek, arched like a running back, ready to shoot the A-gap. It reminded me of something from a Transformers movie, an evil robot just waiting to stand up and spit lasers. I grabbed my hoodie and a pair of sunglasses and followed her across the parking lot. "Quite the bike," I said, sounding a little more nervous than I'd intended.
"That's my baby."
She rubbed her hand down the seat as though it were a pet.
"It's a Triumph Tiger. As good in the dirt as it is on the road."
She jumped on and nodded to me to mount up behind her. When she fired the engine, I could feel the power surge against my thighs and groin. I wrapped my arms around Vicky's waist, the strength of her stomach muscles apparent even through the leather jacket. As if she sensed my apprehension, she turned her head, her lips curled up in a sly smile, and said,
"Don't worry. I got my first dirt bike in fourth grade. I'll take care of you."
We headed out of Buckley on a two-lane highway that cut through a vast plain of green fields. When we came to a long straightaway, Vicky opened the throttle and I tightened my hold on her waist, pressing myself into her as she leaned forward. Over her shoulder, I could see the speedometer climb to 110 before she let off. Despite wearing sunglasses, tears streamed across my cheeks as we settled back down to the speed limit. I have to admit that her acceleration scared the hell out of me. A single pothole or startled pheasant would have been enough to kill us both, Minnesota being a no-helmet state. But at the same time, the rush of adrenaline caused my skin to tingle and my breath to stay high in my chest. It was like one of those carnival rides, the kind with rust on the bolts and grease trailing across peeling paint, whose hinges groan and pop for want of repair. Eventually, something is bound to go wrong. Yet having survived it once, I wanted to do it again. About 15 minutes outside of town, the fields gave way to thick woods, where we dropped into a river valley, crossed a bridge, and climbed back up the opposite valley wall. At the top, she let off of the gas, and we coasted. Up ahead, two farms emerged, one on either side of the road. On the right stood a farmhouse painted a handsome blue with bright white trim. A row of dormer windows jutted out from the roof, and a porch ran along its entire front, the kind of porch that beckoned company to come and sit. The house stood amid a cluster of barns and a grain silo, all painted bright red. On the left was a smaller house, a one-level rambler squatting in front of a silo and barn, both in need of a fresh coat of paint. A faded metal shed, white with a gray sliding door, stood next to the house, completing the hodgepodge of mismatched structures. Weeds had invaded much of the property, and a patch of scrub in front of the faded red barn grew unchallenged. The contrast between the two farms told a story of boom and bust, separated by a single stretch of blacktop. I couldn't take my eyes off the rich colors of the farm on the right. Even as Vicky turned into the farmstead on the left, following the gravel driveway around the side of the house and parking in the metal shed.
"Come on," she said, waving me to follow her.
As we walked toward the front of the house, I heard the sound of a door creaking open. We turned the corner to find a man in his late 50s, unshaven, his shirt pitted from days of wear. He held a cup in his hand, and although I was still 15 feet away, I swear I could smell alcohol seeping from his body.
"Hi, Pop," Vicky said.
"Who's your friend?" he asked, pointing his whiskey mug at me.
"This..." Vicky looked at me with a strange expression of betrayal on her face. "This is Joe Talbert, Toke's son. Joe, this is my father, Ray."
I started to take a step toward Ray, my hand reaching out in greeting, but the old man pulled back and glared at me.
"Get off my property," he said.
"Dad, he's not Toke. He didn't even know Toke.
He's a Talbert, ain't he? I'll have no Talbert on my land. Never. Get him out of here."
For a second, I thought Ray might throw his mug at me. His hands trembled as he snorted air in and out of his bulbous nose.
"Calm down, Dad. I'm showing him the Hicks farm."
Vicky's tone remained tranquil, dismissive, replying to her father as though she were telling him how her day went.
"I'll be back in a little bit."
"Don't you go over there," he said. "You got no business on that farm."
"Just go watch some TV. I'll be in to fix your supper later."
"Don't you be bringing that Talbert back here. You hear me?"
"Go inside, Dad."
Vicky walked down her driveway with me in tow. I looked over her shoulder and saw that Ray remained on the porch watching us. He He pointed at me, I suppose to let me know that he'd be keeping an eye on me. I could tell that he had been a big guy at one time, but his build, like his silo and barn, had succumbed to the ravages of time. His big hands were knotted and bent, his back curved.
Don't worry about him, she said. He wasn't a fan of Tokes.
I could tell. As we were about to cross the highway, a car came from our right, a red Lexus. I had seen that car parked at the Caspian Inn a couple doors down from my room. We waited for the car to pass, and as it neared us, it slowed. Uncle Charlie sat behind the wheel, looking at us, at me, like my mere presence on Earth irritated the hell out of him. After he passed, he kicked the accelerator and sped away.
That was creepy, Vicky said.
You know who that was?
No, but he's been at the bar all day.
That's Toke's brother, Charlie, I said. She looked at the car as it shrank into the distance.
Should have guessed that was Toke's brother. He kept staring at my ass every time I walked past him.
We started across the highway, but Vicky stopped, and again she looked in the direction of the disappearing car.
You know, now that I think about it, I've seen him before. Yeah, he was at the bar a few weeks ago with Toke, arguing about something or other.
Does the sheriff know that?
I only call in the law when things get really out of hand. They were arguing, but it wasn't a fight.
Do you know what the argument was about?
I didn't catch it all, but it was mostly name-calling. Toke was yelling something about him having no obligation, and that guy Charlie was calling Toke a selfish son of a bitch. It didn't last too long before Toke got up and left.
Was Charlie around the night Toke died?
I didn't see him again until this morning.
You sure?
He's got a face that stands out.
Vicky gave a light chuckle.
Who'd have thought that Toke was the good-looking one in the family?
The Hicks property didn't have what you might call a driveway.
Rather, it had a large gravel turnaround that narrowed to one lane where it met the road.
The house lay straight ahead, and a long red barn stood to my right. Both buildings had yellow police tape crossing their doors. The place smelled of hay and dirt and manure, but seemed to glimmer in the evening sun. She led us around the side of the house and down a gravel trail that took us past a grain silo and a second red barn, a path becoming dotted with hoofprints.
Toke had livestock? I asked. Not for very long, she said. Hicks raised cattle. He also raised a few horses back when Jeannie was a kid. My dad always thought that the horses were Hicks's way of spoiling his daughter.
Where are the cows now?
Toke sold them off as soon as he and Jeannie took over the place. Cattle are work, and Toke wasn't much for farming, which is too bad because he inherited one hell of a chunk of land.
Vicky took me to the edge of a knoll, beyond which the land sloped gently into a broad river valley, green crops stretching out at the horizon. She pointed and swept her arm from left to right.
This is your farm, she said.
Holy crap, I whispered, looking out at a sea of green where leaves of the corn rippled lightly in the breeze. On my drive to Buckley, I had passed mile upon mile of farm fields. A view that I thought might cause me to fall asleep behind the wheel, but now the sway of the crops nearly took my breath away.
Ain't it beautiful?
Gorgeous, I said. But I thought you said Toke wasn't much of a farmer.
Oh God, no. This ain't Toke's doing. He rented out the land before Hicks was cold in his grave. As soon as the lawyer said the farm was going to Jeannie, Toke was on the phone getting bids. The only part of the property that ain't under lease is the house and the horse barn.
How did Hicks die?
Heart attack.
So, no chance that Toke might have, you know.
Killed Hicks? It crossed our minds. Don't get me wrong, I think Toke had it in him, but no. It was a heart attack.
How many acres are we talking about here?
Dad once told me that Hicks owned about 750 acres.
750?
Yeah. But don't quote me on that.
I didn't even know what an acre of land looked like, my life having been defined by city blocks. But that much land might be the kind of thing that could persuade a man like Toke to forsake his nomadic bachelorhood and start a family. I also had a better understanding of Charlie's effort to gain guardianship of Angel. I pictured Angel in her hospital bed, clinging to life, and I suddenly felt like a jerk. Here I stood, calculating angles and motivations for a land grab, while this girl, who was probably my sister, lay in a coma. All around me lurked the remnants of her fallen life. The barn where both her mother and father died. The house where she tried to kill herself. I felt ashamed at how easily she had become just another chess piece in my mind.
"Did you know Angel?" I asked.
"I was 10 years old when Angel was born. That age when all a girl wants to do is hang around babies. I remember Jeannie bringing her out here to the farm a couple of times. I ran across the road, and Jeannie let me hold Angel. Thinking back now, though, I don't think Toke knew about those visits."
"Why do you say that?"
"At the time, I didn't think nothing of it. But when I was older, after I got the job at Snipe's Nest and got to know Toke a little better, I got the feeling that he controlled Jeannie, told her where she could go, who she could be friends with. And he used to say terrible things about Angel, calling her retarded and referring to her as his idiot daughter."
"Was she
retarded? No, just fragile. I would see her in town every once in a while. Toke and them only lived a block and a half from the bar back then. She would keep to herself, and she never answered with more than a word or two before she excused herself from the conversation and left. She reminded me of one of those scared dogs, afraid of its own shadow. Don't get me wrong, she was sweet, but, well, fragile."
"Where was Toke killed?"
"In the horse barn. Come on."
Vicky turned and headed back down the trail, cutting across a dirt path that led to the back door of the barn. Crime scene tape had been stapled in two big X's across the doorway. She pulled it free and we stepped inside. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the dim light of the barn. It was long and narrow, with empty horse stalls down one side. The walls were filled with nails holding horse tack, gears, mower blades, and tools. The barn had a row of high west-facing windows, through which the waning sun glowed, speckled with dust. Vicky pointed up at a thick crossbeam about 3 feet above our heads.
"Jeannie hung herself from this beam."
"You saw her?"
"I had just gotten home and was sitting on my porch watching the stars when I saw Angel come out of her house. She called for Jeannie and looked around the courtyard."
"Where was Toke?"
"He wasn't home. So Angel wandered down to the barn and opened the front door. Next thing I knew, Angel was screaming her head off. I came over here as fast as I could. When I got here, Angel was holding Jeannie up by her legs. You know, trying to get her loose from the rope. There was a bale of hay on its side. Like Jeannie had stood on the bale and kicked it over to hang herself."
Vicky looked up at the beam as she paused in her story. Then she shook her head and said,
"She was dead already. There was nothing we could do."
The barn turned quiet as I stared at that beam and pictured a woman hanging from it. My trance was broken when Vicky said,
"They found Toke over here."
She led me toward the front door, where she flipped on a light.
"He was over there."
She pointed to a dark spot on the bottom of the wall about 10 feet inside the barn.
"He was lying on his stomach, with his head pressed against the wall."
I bent down to look at a dark stain on the lower boards of the barn wall.
"That's blood from his head," she said. "I heard they beat him with some kind of gear or something."
I touched the stain of my father's blood. This wasn't a mugshot on a computer screen. It wasn't the bitter stories told by my drunken mother. This was real. This was the blood from his head. And it occurred to me that if Toke Talbert turned out to be my father, this would be the closest I would ever come to touching the man who made me. I remained squatting and stared at the spot of blood.
"Are you okay?"
Vicky asked. I shrugged. "It's just strange, I guess. Knowing that this is where someone killed my father. That's Talbert blood there. And I'm a Talbert. It's just, I don't know."
"You may be a Talbert, but you ain't nothing like the Talbert who died here."
"Your dad doesn't seem to agree with you," I said. "I think he wanted to punch me when you introduced us back there."
"Sorry about that. My father has issues."
She didn't need to say the word alcoholic. His appearance and actions back at her house said the word for her. She dropped her eyes as though embarrassed. "My mother has issues like that," I said, trying to be sympathetic. In fact, that's a good part of why I left home to go to college. I guess you could say that I ran away from home to go to school.
I could never do that, she said. He needs someone to take care of him, and I'm all he's got.
Vicky went quiet, and in that silence, I remembered something that she had said back at the bar. She had told me that going to college wasn't in the cards for her. I stupidly assumed that she didn't have the grades for it, but that wasn't it at all.
Is that why you didn't go to college? I asked. Because of your father? It sounds dumb, I know, but I can't leave him alone. It's more than just the alcohol. Something happened that messed him up, emotionally. It's gotten so bad that he can hardly function anymore.
Does it have something to do with Toke? I asked. Is that why he wanted to rip my head off when you told him my name?
Vicky nodded her head slowly and said, It has everything to do with Toke. Your father is the reason that my mom is dead, and why my dad can't get out of bed in the morning.
My bewilderment must have been plain on my face because she followed with,
Come with me. There's something I want to show you.
Chapter 15. The sun was already beginning to set when I once again got on the back of Vicky's Tiger. Her father either didn't hear us walk past his house or decided that he had made his point and didn't need to come out again. Vicky drove us back in the direction of town, but when we crossed the river, she pulled the bike over to the side of the highway and parked at the top of a boat access. We dismounted, and she walked me to the bridge to a spot where a 3-foot-tall concrete wall rose up from the bridge deck. She pointed at the leading edge of the wall, where a chunk about the size of a watermelon wedge had been busted off.
This is where my mom died.
Vicky brushed her fingers along the damage and then stepped around the side of the bridge and started down the embankment.
Mom was coming home from work when it happened. Would have been 10 years ago now. Her car rolled down here and landed upside down in the river.
At the bottom of the hill, she walked to a fallen cottonwood tree and sat on its trunk, leaving space beside her for me to join. I did.
Toke came out to the farm that night. Back then, he drove this piece of shit Ford, the kind you see in movies from the 70s, bright red, like fire engine red. He came out around sunset. I remember because I had plans that night, and I was waiting for the sun to go down.
Plans?
Vicky smiled to herself. I was a teenager, and in love. The boy lived on this side of town, and
Vicky pointed across the river.
See that gap in the trees over there?
I squinted in the dying light to see it, and could just make out an opening cut to the left of the blacktop.
Yeah, I said. Remember how I told you that I've had a bike since 4th grade? Well, I have trails all over back there.
She waved her hand at the woods across the river.
That gap in the trees is where one of my trails comes out. I could ride it all the way to my boyfriend's place and only touch the road a couple times.
This was 10 years ago?
Yep.
Why would Toke be going out to see Hicks? From what I've put together, Hicks and Toke hated each other by then.
Toke was raising all kinds of hell that night. Me and Dad went to the porch to watch it all. Toke parked in the courtyard and was banging his fist on the door of the house, screaming for Hicks to come out and face him. About then, Hicks came out of the horse barn carrying some kind of pipe. He told Toke to get off his property. He said that if Toke didn't leave, he'd bash his head in. That didn't seem to scare Toke in the slightest. He jumped off the porch and squared up with Hicks, making sure to stay beyond Hicks's reach.
What were they fighting about?
Jeannie, as always. That was around the time that Hicks told Jeannie he was going to cut her out of his will. Jeannie must have told Toke about that, because he was calling Hicks a monster and evil, and just about everything under the sun. He wanted to know what kind of a man would forsake his own daughter and granddaughter.
You heard all this?
Yeah, we had a front row seat. Dad was ready to call the cops if things got out of control, but it never came to blows. Toke finished his tirade and told Hicks that if he wanted to put his daughter and granddaughter in the poorhouse, well, he could go to hell. Then Toke jumped into his truck and lit out of here like a crazy man.
Vicky didn't move as she spoke, her gaze locked on the murky water beyond us.
After Toke left, I thought it was dark enough for me to sneak over to my boyfriend's place.
I rolled my mini bike down through the hayfield behind my house, push-starting it as I went. When I crossed the bridge, I saw the scattered parts of my mom's car. I didn't know what it was at first, just a bunch of busted plastic in the road. I stopped to look around and saw her taillights glowing just under the surface of the water. I ran down to see if I could help. That's when I recognized her car.
Vicky sniffed and folded her fingers together.
I pulled my mother from the car and dragged her to the bank. That river may seem calm, but I promise you there's a powerful current out there. I almost lost my grip. After I got her on the shore, I tried mouth to mouth. I hit her in the chest. I did everything I could think of to get her to breathe again. No cars came by. No help. So I got on my bike and raced home to get my dad. He called the ambulance and we came back down here.
Vicky pointed to a small clearing near the bottom of the boat launch where the ground was fairly level.
That's where she was lying.
Vicky wiped silent tears from her eyes.
There was nothing we could do.
As she spoke, Vicky became small and vulnerable. No longer the Hellcat who taunted death on a motorcycle, but a woman holding in her hands the broken heart of her 14-year-old self. I wanted to put my arm around Vicky, but there were so many reasons why that was a bad idea. Instead, I let her face the memory alone while I sat by, a voyeur to her pain. When she seemed to come back to the present, I asked, "Toke?"
She nodded. When they pulled Mom's car from the river the next day, they found red paint on the side. The skid marks showed that she caught the shoulder and was trying to regain control when she ran into the bridge wall.
Couldn't they match the paint to Toke's truck? Vicky looked at me with a wry smile and said,
"By some freakish coincidence, Toke's truck was stolen that very night. He reported it gone before the ambulance carrying my mother even made it back to town. It's never been found. My bet is that it's at the bottom of the river somewhere between here and Buckley."
So they could never prove Toke hit your mom's car?
The county attorney said that without matching the paint to Toke's truck, all he had was speculation.
So, that's why your dad hates me.
He doesn't need a trial to tell him what's what. And you being Toke's boy, well, that's a little too much for him to take, I guess.
"I'm sorry about your mom," I said. "I'm sorry that my dad was such a..." Vicky put her hand on my forearm.
"Joe, I'm not like Harley, or my dad for that matter. I don't think you carry the sins of your old man with you. You didn't even know him."
"But somehow I feel guilty for being his son. I know I shouldn't."
"This is all on Toke, not you. You've no responsibility for your father."
"Like you have for yours?"
She slid her hand off of my arm and returned her gaze to the water, now black against the closing dusk. "My dad used to be something," she said. "When I was a kid, he was my hero. I would watch him chop wood or string up a fence and think how lucky I was to have a dad like him. That all went away when Mom died. After the funeral, he took to his bed and didn't get up for days. He was never one to shy away from a drink or two, but after she died, he went at it with a passion. He gave up on just about everything. The farm went to pot. He sold off a good chunk of the land."
"And you've been taking care of him ever since?"
"I'm his daughter. What choice did I have?"
"He's your father," I said quietly. "He has no right to ask that of you."
No sooner had those words rolled off my tongue than I regretted saying them. Over the years, to assuage my guilt, I had convinced myself that Kathy's downfall wasn't my fault. I was merely an eyewitness to her undoing. I didn't force her into addiction. I didn't twist her thoughts and emotions into knots. She made those choices, and she had no right to use those bad choices to mess with my life. At least, that's how I saw it. Vicky, apparently, saw it differently. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's none of my business." She didn't respond one way or the other. She just stared calmly into the night. It had gotten dark enough that we could no longer see the river in front of us, although the lapping of its current filled the night air. At some point, our shoulders had touched, and I could feel her leaning into me. The hairs on the back of my neck found a chill in the breeze, or maybe it was something else. Either way, I knew that the time had come to leave. It's getting late, I said.
Yeah, I should probably get you back to town.
We rode slowly back to Buckley, the tiger tamed as we cruised down the smooth black highway. We cut through town on the way to my motel, and as we passed the Snipe's Nest, I spied Harley Redding standing outside of the bar talking to the same two guys he'd been sitting with earlier. Vicky had to have noticed him, although she didn't show it. But Harley noticed us. He nudged one of the guys and pointed. As we passed by, he yelled out something. I couldn't make it out, with the wind whistling past my ears. Chapter 16. As I waited for Jeb to pick me up for our trip to Mankato, I sent a text to Lila. A text because I wasn't ready for the conversation that awaited us. I told her that I was on my way to see Angel, thus fulfilling the reason for my trip to Buckley. I ended the text by wishing her good luck on her studying, my way of letting her know that there was no need to respond. Cowardly, I know. Jeb pulled into the lot just after 8 a.m., driving a black Ford Explorer, his personal vehicle. We would have a little over an hour of driving, and I had made it my goal to use that time to impress Jeb. For one thing, other than Vicky Pike, Jeb was the only other person in Buckley who seemed to want to talk to me. For another, I had an idea on how to draw Moody Lynch out of the woods, and I needed Jeb's help.
Got you some coffee, he said as I climbed in.
I'd already downed a cup of coffee, but as far as I was concerned, there was always room for more. I waited for the Explorer to bounce out of the rough motel parking lot before venturing my first sip.
I made some calls yesterday, he said. I thought you should know that I don't think you had any part in what happened to Toke.
I appreciate that, I said. I honestly didn't know the man was alive until I saw your press release, at which point he was dead.
That's what your editor said.
You called Allison?
I called a few people. I can't speak for the sheriff, but I crossed you off my list.
Is Charlie Talbert still on your list? Jeb paused, as if considering what to say before he answered.
This is Sheriff Kimball's show, not mine.
But you think Charlie's a possible suspect?
Not as far as the sheriff is concerned.
You're dancing, I said.
Investigations are confidential, Joe. I'm not at liberty to discuss it.
It's the fire, isn't it? The one that killed Charlie's business partner.
How do you know?
Jeb caught himself and pulled back.
Joe, there's stuff I can talk about and stuff I can't. You get my drift? People say that you're a guy to be trusted, but I can't go where you want me to go.
People say I can be trusted?
Like I said, I checked you out.
He looked at me sideways, as if waiting for me to guess. Finally, he said,
I called the Minneapolis PD. They told me about what happened when you were in college.
I thought those records were confidential.
They're non-public. That's not the same. Besides, I'm a cop. I can get my hands on all kinds of secret stuff. That's quite the adventure you had. Hell, you're a hero.
It sounds cooler than it was, I said.
You brought down a serial killer.
I almost got myself killed. My girlfriend, too.
But you solved a crime that was 3 decades old. That's impressive.
I was an idiot. I was impulsive and lucky, that's all. My girlfriend, Lila, she should get the credit. She was the brains. My only contribution was to stumble through it without getting killed.
And I hear that you got some reward money for not getting killed.
Yeah, $100,000. I thought I was rich, but you'd be amazed how fast money drains away when you have college and law school tuitions to deal with. After all was said and done, we had to take out a loan to pay for Lila's 3rd year.
Well, the folks up in the city speak highly of you. I also hear that you're a pretty fair reporter.
Fair? I'd say I'm better than fair.
No, I mean, fair in that you don't have an agenda. You keep confidences.
I thought about the lawsuit and my source, Penny. I was on the verge of losing my job because I was being fair. I was keeping my word, and it had landed me in the middle of a defamation suit that made my stomach churn every time I thought about it. All I had to do was give her up, and I'd be out of that jam. But I don't give up sources. And because of that, people, even cops, thought that I was a fair reporter. Yeah, I can keep a secret, I said. So, is the sheriff still looking at Moody to be Toke's killer?
Again, confidential.
What if someone were able to get Moody to come out of hiding? Maybe get his statement? Would that help?
Someone like you?
Exactly, I said.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Hear me out. I could help.
You're a reporter.
A fair-minded reporter, don't forget that part.
You're Toke's son.
That's not for sure until that DNA test comes back.
Doesn't matter, it's a bad idea all around.
Maybe, but I really think I can help.
How?
Like you said, I'm a reporter for the Associated Press.
That carries some weight.
Jeb gave me a questioning glance.
What do you mean?
You want to find Moody Lynch, right?
Yeah.
And from what I've heard, if Moody doesn't want to be found, you won't find him. Would you agree?
He knows how to hide. I'll give him that.
He's hiding because he doesn't trust cops. He probably thinks Nathan Calder will set him up.
I heard those two have issues.
Issues?
I could see that Jeb was testing me to see what I knew about Nathan's entanglement. So I obliged.
Moody caught Nathan Calder having sex with some woman from the court administrator's office. Moody videotaped their tryst and sent a copy to Nathan's wife.
How am I doing so far?
Not bad.
And you expect Moody to just come waltzing into the sheriff's office and turn himself in to Calder? That'll never happen.
We'll find him, one way or another.
Jeb, people sometimes call reporters because they want their stories in print as protection against bad cops. It's the old saying, sunlight is the best disinfectant. They understand that if their story is out there for the public to read, there's less chance they'll be railroaded.
We don't railroad people.
But suppose there was a reporter in town, someone who could write Moody's story. Someone with the clout of a major news organization behind him. Moody might be willing to talk to that reporter.
You think Moody will talk to you?
Why not? What's he got to lose?
And if he contacts you, what then?
I get his version, and maybe I can convince him to turn himself in. To you. Not Nathan.
Just like that?
I said, maybe. But if nothing else, I get him to talk. Tell me what happened that night.
You'll let us record it?
No, I won't set a trap. He has to know that I'm independent of you guys or else he won't trust me. And I won't lie to him.
You'll share what he tells you?
I'll make sure he knows it's on the record.
So why are you telling me all this? If you're so independent, you don't need my permission.
I need information. I need to get some of the detail of what happened that night so that I can challenge him. I don't want Moody bullshitting me.
You want me to share investigation details with you?
It's a simple bargain. I'll share if you share.
Or I could just throw you in jail for interfering with an investigation.
I know the law, Jeb. I have no obligation to say a word to you, and my silence won't be a crime. You have no grounds to arrest me as long as I'm not physically getting in your way. All I'm asking for are a few details so that if I have contact with Moody Lynch, I can ask the right questions. Just a few basic facts to get the ball rolling.
If he contacts you, you'll let me know?
If you share, I'll share.
Just give me a thumbnail sketch of what went down.
Jeb paused to consider what I was leading him toward. Lines would need to be crossed, but they were insignificant compared to the possibility of bringing in a man wanted for murder. At least, that's how I saw it. After a minute or two of silent contemplation, Jeb looked me in the eye and said,
"This goes no further than this car, okay?"
"I promise." He fixed his gaze back on the highway and said,
"We got a 911 call that night. Came from the Hicks place, but there was no one on the line. It was a cell phone, but we have the technology to track down cell phones now, especially the newer GPS kind. I was off duty when I heard the call on my scanner. I don't live all that far from the Hicks place, so I was the first to arrive at the scene."
"You were driving this car?"
"Yeah."
"No dash camera?"
"Nathan was in his squad car, so he has footage."
"Can I see it?"
"I thought you just wanted some background."
"Fine. What happened next?"
"There was a light on in the barn, and also in the house. Because there was no voice on the other end of the 911 call, I assumed a medical emergency of some kind. And I went to the house. I knocked. And when I got no answer, I went inside and searched, until I found Angel in her bedroom. I tried to wake her, but she was unconscious.
No one else around when you got there? Did you hear anything?
Not a thing. But I wasn't expecting to find a murder scene. I don't know what I thought. But I didn't think that.
Did you go to the barn?
No. Angel's pulse